clients. And I see it professionally.
Hello, is anyone else there?
Hello.
Hello.
Great.
Hello.
It was so quiet. I wasn't sure if I was connected.
Hello?
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 Hello.
Hi, it's Jovia. I didn't hear anyone.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. I couldn't get onto my own conference line. Thank you for your patience and waiting. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay,
yes.
Super. I'm not sure still about the connection. I may ask you to do a star six through the lecture portion, but let's begin. Remember, we're going to have some time at the end, at the top of the hour, for discussion, questions, things that you'd like to talk more about, and keep that in mind if there's anything else you want to discuss. I have a cluster of questions that are around some aspects of marketing, and especially fees, that I want to reserve for that time. And you'll hear how they're all related about waiver forms, different aspects of that. And I'll discuss each of those, and I think can do it very quickly. So for now, what you got? Questions, thoughts, things that you'd like to discuss further from any of our last three seminars? Anything remaining or that you'd like to further explore or just ask about so far?
Hey, David, this is Leon.
Please, go ahead.
Hey, you know, I just found that, you know, the reframing of objections, very, very helpful, and wonder if you might give maybe one or more examples. I know you touched base on that, I think, in week one.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to just a refresher on possibly a couple of objections and how you reframe them when it comes to moving forward.
Okay, when you say objection, are you talking about mentor coaching with a client and an example of that? Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
We're asking, you know, or wanting to know if they're going to go forward and, you know, they're raising objections.
Okay, I want to talk some about making a recommendation for professional coaching, and I want to develop that in our discussion. But here's the pricey for you to think about. Let's say you do a sample session. You've established a sample session. The client calls you. You've done it for 20 minutes. You save 3 or 4 minutes at the end. You decide you're going to make a recommendation. I want to evoke a model that is very much like any other professional consultation you've had. Now, an imperfect analogy because we don't do consultation, but we do a brief discussion and at the end, or a sample session, and if you make a recommendation, here's what I would recommend to do it in a very clear, brief, succinct way. And remember what we've talked about clarity, brevity, simplicity. And I would use the experience of the sample session that you've conducted with a client because you've given them the experience of what it's like in professional coaching in a 20-minute segment, let's say. So here's one way of doing a recommendation and making that, in my view, as professional as possible. Think about the last time you went to see a doc or a financial professional. You know, they didn't end by saying, well, what do you think about this? Or, yeah, I'd really like to work with you. Think about the model, and here's an example of that. This follows after you've asked that person in a succinct way to summarize what they're taking away and what they commit to do. So you've moved from the focus and the destination to develop that. You've had a complete experience, a story that has a beginning, middle, and end, and the satisfaction of effectiveness with you. So here's one way to frame that recommendation. Based on what we've just talked about as an aspect of something that is extremely important to you and will make a major difference for how you're going to address that, here's what I'd recommend.
I recommend that we work together in mentor coaching with a standing time of 50 minutes where you call me. Can I get a mute on the background noise? Star six, everybody who's not talking. Okay. I would recommend that we work together with a standing time of 50 minutes where you call me. And prior to that time, I'd suggest you do two things. I'm going to send you a client information packet for you to fill out and get back to me. And the last page of that is our agreement of working together. And I'll send you a link for a monthly retainer that covers all of our sessions, material and resources that I send you, plus any email in between. My monthly retainer is whatever you've decided it to be. Any questions? And you set it up where it's recurring every 30 days. So you're clear, brief, succinct, and professional, and think about how it sounds. Now, the first few times you do that, it's not going to feel natural. Script it. Say it 25 times so it sounds like you're saying it the first time. And let's come back to the components of that if you'd like, including fee and that sort of thing in our discussion. Does that make sense for right now for your question about how do you frame a recommendation for professional coaching? Leon?
It does. Am I off mute?
You're off mute. Yeah, I can hear you.
It does. I was thinking in terms of how you reframed, like if they came back after that and maybe commented with, wow, that's awfully expensive. That's a lot more than I was planning to spend. And you had a very nice reframe on a couple of common objections like that. I was curious
I'll tell you, when you do it with clarity and confidence, I don't think it'll happen. I've never had anybody do that in 15 years. But now if somebody does say, well, that is expensive, I'm going to deal with some aspects of objections in this seminar about neuromarketing. I would agree with them. It is a significant investment in your life or your business, and I think you'll see exponential returns. There's nothing you have to justify or defend or anything else. Just, I would agree, it's a significant investment, and I believe you'll see exponential returns. Period. That's all. In my house, we call it white space. There's nothing else that you say. You don't talk anymore. You've framed it. You've done it in a professional way, and you've been very clear and specific.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. All right, great. Think about any questions or things you'd like to talk about that, and we'll come back to it in the discussion time. And jot down anything else you want to be sure we cover. I'll go through some things that I want to say about specifically neuromarketing your professional services, and then we'll come back for a discussion on that and other aspects. Anything that we didn't cover, we'll address. So I'm going to try with my connection. Okay, we're good. We're presentation mode, so you guys can not worry about the mute for right now. So here's the neuromarketing quiz. Jot down your answer. And this very much relates to what we were just talking about with Leon. The Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to examine the major factor that determined whether someone engaged or declined services from a number of different professionals in different professions. What do you think was most important? And the primary reason for accepting was the same as the primary reason for declining. So what do you think it was? Years of experience? Reputation? Amount of the fee? Degrees and certifications? Stating recommendations and fee clearly and confidently? State of the economy. Jot down your answer. We'll come back to that. Here are four questions to consider. I'd suggest you write a yes or no immediately to each of these four. One, do you earn your living by offering others goods or services? Do you work for yourself or run your own operation, even if part-time? Does your work require elastic skills, the ability to do a variety of different functions through the day? And the final question, do you work in education, training, human resources, or healthcare? And that includes professional coaching. If you answer yes to any one of these four questions, you are in sales and service. If you're a doctor, attorney, accountant, consultant, coach, or business professional, you're in sales and service. Now, I don't want you to think about it like that, but we're going to talk about it like that for a minute. To deliver a fantastic experience to your prospects is the best sales strategy there is. So here's a definition, a working definition of neuromarketing. Neuromarketing integrates biological and social sciences to understand unconscious choices and the underlying brain activity that determines behavior of consumers. When we engage potential prospects with a product or service in mind, we invite them to part with their resources, time, attention, effort, money. If they do, we will bring value and they will benefit from the engagement. Teachers sell their students that the science lesson they're teaching is interesting and beneficial. In healthcare, the physical therapist helps someone recover from injury to handle resources, time, attention, effort, because patients can be healthier if they use those resources wisely. To move people effectively and powerfully requires seeing them as a participant and a collaborator, a huge concept for you to incorporate, a participant and a collaborator. Now, here's what happens when people don't do that. When someone consults a physician, they go to an expert, they get expert advice. How well do they follow that expert advice when they're in pain and go to the trouble and expense of seeking out and getting help? If that expert recommendation is in the form of a prescription, let's say, less than 50% actually follow the physician's advice because they don't fill the prescription. Of those who do fill it, slightly less than 50% take it as directed. So even with fear, pain, inconvenience, less than 25% actually follow that expert advice. Why is that? It's not their story. It's the physician's story, most likely. Consider this question for yourself, and I want you to write down a specific number as soon as you hear the question. What percent of your real work involves convincing or persuading people to give up something they value for something you have, something that will bring them great value? Over 10,000 professionals around the world were surveyed with this question. Nearly everyone considered it a crucial component of their success, even if they framed it, I think, more relevantly as a recommendation for professional services based on an assessment. Yet, while most people have direct persuasion and believe direct persuasion is crucial, the time allocated to doing this and developing this aspect of their practice, including marketing, is in the single digits. What we find valuable and what we actually do may significantly differ. When we work for ourselves as entrepreneurs, we become salespeople as well. What people in sales do is move people. You can tell the ones who don't do this. Their kids get really skinny. The persuasion industry, now led by neuromarketing, focuses on most everything we buy. What we purchase for emotional reasons and then justify by logic is shaped in ways so subtle that we may have failed to recognize them. An example of a failure in influence. A cigar manufacturer spent considerable money on an advertisement that depicted a beautiful smiling woman handing out cigars to her husband and his friends. This was attractively done in an elegant English library setting and widely displayed. The result was a dramatic fall in cigar sales. What happened? What they found, when men smoke cigars, they unconsciously feel dominant and important. I didn't say I endorse this, and I didn't say it was. By showing a woman encouraging a man to smoke and being subservient to her offering, the advertisement psychologically countered the male's customer's intent. Remember, we're not focusing on anything other than cigar sales here. So, some misconceptions about selling. For several years, my good buddy Art Wilson was the number one salesperson in IBM's group of over 10,000 healthcare sales professionals before he moved to a senior executive position there. Then he took an early retirement to start his own hugely successful consulting company, working with sales forces of multinational corporations, and co-founded with me our retreats, What's Next Exec. Now, you'd never guess he was in sales. He's a big, gentle, laid-back, lovable guy, kind of like me. In researching this material, I asked him if there are common misconceptions about selling. Here are the two biggest misconceptions he passed on. One, selling is a natural gift. For more than 90% of people, including the most successful salesperson, this is not true. Someone may do the right thing for the right reason, but it has to be combined with the right style and emotion. It's an art and science with its own body of knowledge. And the second misconception, the biggest and the best salespeople with the biggest sales have no call reluctance. Overnight, and Art said, man, he was shy. He had called. He would rather do anything than man. Over 90% of the best salespeople regularly have call reluctance, but they do it anyhow by getting in the optimum state of mind and sticking to their plan. Pick people you want to reach out to and do it. You don't have to be motivated, but you do have to have a plan and stick to it. Shrink the change, a designated number of contacts a day. From a number of conversations and interviews with outstanding sales professionals, these two questions form the heart of the sales exchange. One, if the person you're selling to agrees to buy, will his or her life improve? Two, when your interaction is over, will the world be a better place than when you began? If the answer to either of these questions is not yes, you probably need to recalibrate. It's said that marketers often make these mistakes, assuming people are rational, assuming people are eager for change, and assuming that once someone knows things the way you know them, they're going to choose what you choose or offer. In fact, besides these mistakes, it's what you think you already know that will most prevent you from learning. So let's look at the 1% now. Professor Herod Koch teaches law and emphasizes that in an attempt to understand the law or in understanding just about anything, the key is to focus on the 1%, to not get lost in the details, but to think about the essence of what's really important, the 1% that gives life to the other 99%. Understanding that 1%, and especially being able to explain it to others, is the hallmark of a strong position. The 1% is the essence of simplicity and clarity, whether you're selling a product or a service, or trying to offer anyone anything. What's the 1%? You have to answer that. You're not going to necessarily convey that, but you have to know that. It adds to confidence, clarity, and centeredness in what you're doing. When you can answer that question and then find a way meaningfully to convey it to others, you and they are likely to be moved. Einstein said, if you can't state your position simply, you don't understand it well enough. Seth Godin, probably the best-known marketer in the world, doubled down to Einstein and said, if you can't state your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. The purpose of the 1%, or think of the purpose of a pitch or a hub statement, is not necessarily to move someone else to adopt your idea. The purpose is to offer something so compelling that it begins a conversation. The measure of success after your statement is when the other person says, oh, tell me more. The other person begins being a participant to eventually arrive, ideally, at the outcome that appeals to both of you. So there are three types of value propositions, three most common types. To articulate your 1%, consider these most common types of value propositions. The one-word pitch. What's the one characteristic that you want associated with your name, your business, your brand? A one-word equity. When anyone thinks of you, they associate that word. When anyone says that word, they think of you. The most recent example that I think of was to look at how I wanted to name the Peak Performance Training, so I made up a word, neuromentor. It amalgamated psychology, neuroscience, and mentor coaching. So I trademarked it and then began a series of offerings. Other examples, each to date, are a little more famous than neuromentor. What technology company do you think of when you hear the word search? What credit card company comes to mind when you hear the word priceless? In his 2012 re-election campaign, President Obama built his entire strategy around one word, forward. The second is the question pitch. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was running for president of the United States in a really grim economy. He simply asked the question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? It was designed to make people come up with their own reasons for agreeing or not. When they came up with their own answers for agreeing or believing something, they endorsed the belief more strongly because it became their story. Remember, we earlier talked about it's not what you say to someone that is going to make the difference. It's what they say to themselves on the basis of what you said that's going to determine how they proceed. And the third is the Twitter pitch. Brief, simple, specific, a micro message, at least in the old days, of 140 or fewer characters. The mark of an effective tweet, like an effective pitch, is that it engages recipients and encourages them to take the conversation further. That's common to each of these. Further may be responding, sharing a tweet, clicking a link, signing on for a seminar. What tweets do you think have the highest rating? Readers assign the highest rating to tweets that ask questions of followers. This confirms the power of questions to engage and to persuade. Remember we talked about when you give information, facts, data, there's a counter to that naturally. But when you ask a question, there's nothing to oppose. You begin a conversation, ideally an engagement. So listen to learn. Asking the right questions has more power than giving people the right answers. Way more. Appreciative inquiry can get much better results than seeking out and solving problems. So the preparation would be to focus on your purpose and your plan. Here are three key questions to help you prepare your value proposition. You will clarify your purpose by making sure you can answer these three simple questions. What do you want someone to know? What do you want someone to feel? And what do you want someone to do? And then your plan. Write down these four things. before you connect with a prospect, what would we talk about that would be the highest value objective of a client for that interaction? If it's a sample session, then it's to co-create a story based on the client as point of reference with a simple coaching model, a map that has a beginning, middle, and end. And think about what you want to do, how you want to keep that conversation focused on the client to evolve and direct it so that it gives the best possible experience for someone to result in effectiveness and in a plan. This is the best possible thing that you can do, is to show someone what it's like to work together in professional coaching. Telling them won't have nearly the same impact. You co-create an experience. For most people, the opposite of talking isn't listening, it's waiting. When others speak, we usually divide our attention between what they're saying now and what we're going to say next. And that may result in a kind of mediocre halfway position. The framework of the initial conversation with a client is one of collaboration. The reference point is the client. Some professionals don't even bother to wait. Here's a typical study that found that physicians interrupt the majority of patients in the first 18 seconds if they begin to speak in an appointment. This often prevents the patient from describing what brought them into the office in the first place. It becomes the physician's story, not the patient's story. Here's an example of listening differently. Suppose you're raising money for a charity, and this is sort of back to Leon's question about framing, and you ask someone to contribute $200. If she says, well, sorry, I can't give $200, consider that an offer. Frame it as an offer. Perhaps you can donate a smaller amount. Or she may say, no, I can't give it right now. Consider reframing that as an offer as well. Focus on the right now and ask when might be a better time. Or even consider the entire sentence as an offer, perhaps to contribute to your charity in some other way, such as being a volunteer. This way to hear responses reframed as offers can come in all shapes and sizes. To reframe the way you listen to also inform the way you respond. When both parties view the encounter as an opportunity to learn, the whole idea of selling or winning sort of fades. It's a non-issue. It's a different mindset of collaboration and engagement. When we move from selling to serving, we engage the recipient as a collaborator and become empathically attuned to their needs, to their story, and our effectiveness in benefiting that person. Our effectiveness as a coach in being a catalyst to help them shape and further their story. This non-salesy selling is the ability to influence, persuade, and change behavior while crafting a link between what others want and what you can provide them. We elicit from people what their specific goals are and frame what we can do to help them achieve those goals. So you'll see in the outline some more detail about this next aspect, sales mastery, that there are three phases: engage, enroll, and create conviction. I'm going to let you look at that and sort of review it yourself, because I'm emphasizing that what we do in professional coaching as a professional is we don't sell anything. We do make a professional recommendation for our services, and we need to know what someone wants to do, their needs and challenges, what they see as a benefit, and how we can help them achieve that. And there's a model. If you use the simple coaching model, that's the map of beginning, ending, and how to progress along the way. With a map, you know where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, how to manage that time as a mentor coach. And you can also tell what's deter and distraction, so you may interrupt if someone goes off into the weeds or if they begin sort of free associating in the way most people have conversations. We may help them shape that in a coaching conversation to make progress with that map, because that's the framework that we work in coaching. So, four keys to effective contact for you. Set a specific goal. Think about an illustration here, if that's to conduct a sample session. Have fun while you're doing it. Remember my favorite grandmother? If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Plus, a state of mind is simply the most contagious of anything, faster than the fastest virus. Have a plan for how you're going to conduct it, the map, and do it as many times as you possibly can. When someone begins their training with me at CTA, you know, I will usually mention in the first class that the minimum requirement is 20 sample sessions. The minimum paying clients by the end of the training is 2 clients. Consider this. That's a pretty good 1-to-10 conversion ratio for beginning coaches. But consider this. If you do 100 sample sessions, you're going to have a way better conversion rate than 1 out of 10, because you're going to get better and better at it. You're going to pre-select. You're going to prepare someone better. You're going to conduct it better. And you're going to get more fluid and more confident in the recommendation. So you're going to have way more than 10 at the end. So if you are more likely to stop yourself from making contact if you're not in a peak state, or believe that you're in an interruption, this can be a limiting assumption. To engage the prospect, connection and rapport are the foundation of all persuasion. Prospects will choose you because they trust you, like you, and especially because they have confidence in you. And that says you have confidence in yourself, because that's the contagious state of mind. The confidence is the belief that you can help them get what they want or need. Importantly, they will choose you because they believe you have their best interest at heart. So this has to be totally authentic. Now, the answer to the Wharton School of Business quiz, the single factor most determined whether someone engaged or declined professional services, the clarity and confidence of stating the recommendation and fee. And notice, it doesn't take more than a single sentence to make the recommendation of what you do and what that would involve. Caring people buy from caring people and will even help you close as long as you have their best interests at heart. People want to feel cared for. We all want to be appreciated. People love people who change their state. That's why entertainers are paid so much more than educators, pro athletes more than service people. We want to be around people who change our state for the better. And here's a law of reciprocation. Whatever you put out, it will come back manyfold, whether that's positive or negative. So look at the other aspects of the components, including enrolling, and do that by asking questions, creating an experience, and showing someone, and then move to the conviction. You have to have the conviction first, and then that will come through in your statement. People don't buy facts or features. They buy benefits for themselves. Again, selling is the transfer of emotion. For someone to buy, they must feel certain they will get what they want. Again, think about the last time you went to a physician and that physician made a recommendation. Physician didn't sell anything. There was hopefully clarity, specificity, brevity, and a very clear recommendation about what action to take, what you'd do, what that person would do. Then you can respond with the same confidence that the person has in making the recommendation. If you don't have that feeling of confidence, and be sure you distinguish that from other kinds of trepidation, anxiety, all that, If you don't have the confidence, it probably should be a no. So conviction has to start with you first, then your client. And they have to, though, buy what they buy or attend their event for their reasons, not yours. So the number one way here is to give them the experience and conviction that they'll get what you want, what they want, importantly, what they want about your service or product. The number two way, match to their number one value. For example, if it's freedom, show them how it will enhance their freedom. Find the dominant emotion for buying, even though the prospect will want to believe it's for logical reasons. Copywriters tell us there are five great motivators for marketing. One is fear. Car and life insurance people use this. Exclusivity, to be special or chosen. When narcissism goes shopping, a sense of specialness appeals, even creates a special bond, an exclusive offer, a private invitation. Another, greed. Although it has a negative connotation, the true meaning of greed is a rapacious desire for more, to succeed massively. Guilt. Nonprofits sometimes use this. And the need for approval. Product advertisements for cars and watches to participate in the status, especially when there's celebrity induction and that sort of thing. So the task of sales involves the science of neuromarketing. The questions you ask people determine what they focus on. And this is important. Anytime we're only focusing on a small band of data, our attention is a very limited resource. We want to use it very wisely. What's available to us? Our brains are like a camera in that we only see what we focus on. So help the client focus. Do one feature at a time, not a whole bunch. This is the benefit and the effectiveness of speaking clearly, briefly, simply. This is the effectiveness of knowing that we attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time, not a paragraph. And our imagination is 10 times more powerful than our will. Fear is the number one reason that stops action. Learn how to utilize imagination. Guide visualization to make it real for people and paint it vividly. Ask questions. When you ask a question, it changes what someone focuses on. Whenever someone is focused on negative reasons, the fear, ask a question to refocus on the gain. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. Emphasize choosing the short pain. Experience the discomfort and use your energy to move ahead. Delaying the pain delays progress. Make it real and assume the sale. When people don't buy, it's because they've linked buying with more pain than not buying. When people do buy, they link buying with more pleasure than not buying. And remember again, I'm going to reiterate, people buy for emotional reasons and justify with logic. And let's talk a little bit about converting objections into commitments. If someone has an objection, if they're framing something in a negative way, I wouldn't go along with them. In other words, rather than counter or ignore or circumvent it, find out specifically what it is. An objection equates to getting more information. The best salespeople average 5 objections before a conversation. Be sure that an objection is not the projected voice of the seller. So an objection is a question in disguise. That's a specific reframe. It provides an opportunity to hear the primary concern so it can be addressed and reframed, to understand the person's belief and fear, and to listen to the real questions. So objections are signposts. They're your resources. A mistake is to engage or to fight the objection. The key to influence is to align with the person. Remember that circle, to get inside the circle with them. In spite of the fear, will the benefit be greater of doing it? If the answer is yes in their gut, they will proceed. The best way to respond to an objection is to take each objection and interpret it as a question. This is a specific kind of reframing. Rather than a reason for not buying, hear it as a request for more information. Let me give you an example. I can't afford it. Reframed here, please show me how I can afford it so it's worth it. I have to talk it over with someone else. Reframed, please give me enough reasons I can go ahead and buy it without having to check and get somebody else's opinion. Welcome an objection because it's information. It's a stepping stone to success. Treat an objection as powerful, as important. Perhaps even compliment the objection as a good question, if it is, because it allows both of you to think about and consider it. So, here are some considerations to convert objections into commitments. These are in your outline. Don't engage the objection by countering it. Focus directs attention, so you don't want to focus on the negative. Hear someone out. Feed it back as a question. This puts the objection back to the questioner to examine and then explain. Often when someone tries to explain an objection, they'll withdraw it because their reactivity simply said no. It wasn't their reason, for example. 4, get more information. Is this the real objection? 5, align with the prospect. To collaborate. In a collaboration, you're on the same side. Both of you are in the circle. If you fight an objection, it will limit you. Instead of countering the question or the objection, align with it. For example, I appreciate or I respect how you feel about that. Or it is an expensive investment. Turn the objection into a question. Reframe it. Questions are the genesis of focus. You can't answer an objection, but you can answer a question. It seems like the real question is, can you get enough value to justify buying? It sounds like your concern is, how can you get benefits now? Focus on the benefit rather than the concern. For example, if there's an issue with expense, reframe it. Maybe brag about it. Do it up front. You know what I mean. Do it up front. Assume the sale. The best persuaders assume the sale. Congratulate them on a wise decision. Don't thank them for the sale. The congratulation focuses on a wise decision. So I want to conclude with just a brief discussion on the psychology of closing. This is the most important part, I believe. This is the point that both salesperson and the prospect also may hate the most. So, do it as quickly and as painlessly as possible. Here's an illustration. A man had a painful tooth he knew needed to be extracted. He called his dentist, whose patient he had been for a long time. The two knew each other really well. He asked how much the dentist would charge him to extract a tooth and how long would it take. The dentist said, "Oh, I'll charge you $185, and it'll take less than a minute." The man responded, "Only a minute? That's a lot of money for just a minute." The dentist said, "Well, if time is an issue, I can take as long as you want." Have your closings planned in advance, word for word. But sound natural and spontaneous, like you're talking, not reading a script. Remember, I suggested that you script the recommendation that you make at the end of a sample session. Be sure it sounds like you're talking, not reading a script, or that you haven't practiced 25 times to be sure that it sounds like a natural flow, and that you can remain focused on the client rather than yourself or, you know, trying to get it right. Here are some major requirements for closing. Engage a positive, enthusiastic mindset. Clarify the client's requirements. Help the client understand what you're offering. Facilitate rapport, friendship, and trust. Focus on the benefits the client will get, and match your recommendation to what the prospect needs. Four aspects. The prospect must want it, need it, afford it, and use it. And again, the example that I want to return to is your recommendation at the end of a sample session. You're making a professional recommendation. You're doing it in a couple of sentences, and you're including everything that needs to be included in a professional way as a conclusion of that story you've just co-created with you making a recommendation as a professional. That's what somebody pays you for. That's what the feeling that they get is, how professional are you? How confident are you? What is it going to be like to work with you? They already have that idea. In the sample session, your close, your recommendation brings it all together. Remember the Wharton School of Business study. Clarity and confidence in stating the recommendation and fees. So, some closing strategies. Never tell somebody that they're wrong. People convinced against their will are of the same opinion still. Go with the objection, indicate as a valid concern or as specific information, then engage in the message. You might want to consider getting third-party proof. Someone else who's had a similar objection saying how it worked, how they're glad of a purchase, or just simply after you've done work with a client to see if they would like to do a testimonial or a recommendation for a website, for example. Not during, because you don't want to complicate that. Don't knock the competition. Sell the value and the benefits of your service, your product. Never negative words about others. Don't engage in personal issues with a client. That's a distraction from why they are coming to you as a professional. They rely on you to keep that frame always. Don't assume authority you don't have, like a promise you can't keep that may be overselling. Avoid negative expectations, such as deciding the person will not buy, or the most common of all new coaches, that this person might not be able to afford a significant fee. Remember, the hero is the person, place, product, or brand that enables someone to feel the change your story promises. How can you make your client the hero of his or her own story? Make it clear and create a future. Create a relationship that lasts through the years. The most important part of the engagement is to give more than it is expected, to generate an ongoing relationship, even though you only may work formally together for a few months. You're always going to be available for that client. I've had clients from years ago who've called to say, you know, I have a situation. I need a session for supervision, or I have a situation I need to meet a couple of times to sort this out. And that's exactly what we do. You have an ongoing interest. You're interested in wins and successes as well as any issues you may be able to help with. To prevent buyer's remorse, look at future pacing. Future pace every time somebody purchases. In other words, have buyers imagine themselves in the future, ways they will use the product or service in the future. A year from now, what will you be doing with this training that will make you glad you've done it? Link something present to your product. For example, I did one today at noon. I build into my training of mentor coaches a quarterly mentor group and white paper, and we do mastermind problem solving, and people present issues and challenges. We all talk about it. Build in future anticipation and benefit around specific topics, issues, or a process that is interesting to people. Give them a reason to buy. Theirs, not yours. Emotional and logical. People will put off buying if they can build in units of conviction. Make it fun. Laugh. Change states. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Have I said that before? Here, finally, a summary. Some strategies of successful people, top sellers. Affect your own emotional state. Reset after the last experience. A number one quality. Prepare yourself physically and emotionally. Qualify prospects. Find their deepest needs, their core emotional needs that drive that person, their challenge, their pain point. Then you can know how to collaboratively pursue that in your recommendation. Manage your state and the prospect state in that order. Give prospects a way to justifying buying to satisfy a need. Remain flexible. The person most flexible controls the situation. To be successful, know the outcome. Take action. Know what getting closer and what getting further away looks like and feels like. Change your approach until you get what will benefit the other person. And become a team player, finally. Consistently attune to the prospect's needs. Is there more value than the concern they bring? Create and sustain interest. Imagine this. Imagine inventing a device that can record memories, dreams, ideas, and transmit them to your brain. This device, this game-changing technology, is called storytelling. Have a repertoire of stories that will illustrate points. I do this in mentor coaching all the time. I'll give you an example, in fact, as a response to a couple of questions to illustrate how I might use this with a client. Hold on, and I'll do that in just a moment. So, some additional neuromarketing research findings are in your outline, some aspects of age and gender and about the buying brain. Look at that in your outline because I want to hold our time for discussion and come to the end of this. First, while I'm still on lecture mode, thank you all very much for your participation. All of your input has been hugely helpful to me to shape and include some of the things that you've talked about, you're interested in. There's, as you imagine, a wealth of information in the psychology of influence, the persuasion, neurosciences, neuromarketing, and I hope that I've captured some of the things that will be most relevant and beneficial to you in what you're doing in mentor coaching. So I'm going to put us on discussion mode. I have a couple of things in mind, but I'd like to first hear what's the most important thing you're taking away from this or even the course. Pick one and hear from you. Okay, we're in discussion mode, so you're live if you manage the background noise. I'm interested in hearing any input as well as questions and discussion suggestions from each of you.
Well, hi, Dr. David. I know you said David. Okay. This is Drilby.
Hey, welcome. Hey, thanks.
Well, like I said, I was going to listen to the end to see if you answer my questions, and I really want to thank you. You did. It opened up my eyes on, as you stated in the book, the printout, think like a scientist. And having the humility, developing humiliation. So I guess what I got from that is never thinking you're too right but be willing to learn something new or to be corrected. And as you just brought up, that's collaborating with the client and finding the, and focusing on the client's why and not ours. I did have that misconception based on every practice or coaching you hear, they say, what's your why? So that was like a different persuasion for me. So knowing my why, as in practice, having a good practice, but the focus of helping our clients is the focus on their why. So that's my takeaway, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, and that's really what I had hoped for, because that's exactly what we want to do to make it about the client. And an example of that would be, you know, tell me about what professional coaching is. And if you make it about you and background and experience and all that, the way to keep it about the person is I can answer that by hearing what is your primary challenge right now in your life or your business. And they tell you, that's exactly what I do. I'll help you create and sustain success strategies to deal with that. Or you simply may say, I think it can give you the best appreciation of that to do a sample session. Would you like to schedule that for both of us to get an idea of what it might be like to work together in coaching? Make it about the client. Thanks. Others take away or...
Dave, it's Kathy Hart. How are you?
Yeah, hey, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. I really appreciated the objections that you spoke about, and because those are the hardest, as far as I'm concerned, is to get over. And how do you respond, and what do you do? And so what you said really brought clarity to me on it, and some very good examples. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for that, and I'm glad it was helpful. I believe that when you offer your professional recommendation, if it's like for coaching, and are clear, brief, and succinct about that and specific about what it would be, I don't think you'll experience objections.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing to object to. Someone consulted you to get an idea of what you'd recommend. You make a recommendation, and
mm-hmm.
they're free to agree or not, go along with it or not. Most mm-hmm. likely they will, but you've not done or said anything for them to object to.
Right.
You don't object to a doctor. You go in and see a doctor. You don't start objecting. You go to, you know, a financial professional or an attorney, as you know, someone makes a recommendation. They may ask some questions, but if they start objecting, I just don't have that experience.
Right, that's true, because when you do look to hire somebody for a specific purpose and they're giving you all this information and that's what you're there for, why would there be an objection?
Right. You have begun by entering that circle by asking the client what their greatest challenge is, or if it's a sample session, for example, you've asked them what they'd like to focus on and where they'd like to get to, so you're framing it as a collaborative
mm-hmm.
effort. Collaborators don't oppose each other. They move forward
mm-hmm.
together, and that framework mm-hmm. is fundamental to what we do in professional coaching. That
mm-hmm.
is unique to professional coaching. Every other profession has a consultative model. We have a collaborative model.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that's co-created with the client's point of view. The client is the protagonist for that co-created story. We're simply the catalyst for it. So there's
right.
nothing to sell. It's a professional recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I talk
yeah.
about, you know, sales and neuromarketing, but if you look at it in this way, the whole idea in incorporating the mind and brain and performance sciences is it moves it from sales or anything like that to one
mm-hmm.
collaboration. So great point, well, and I appreciate you, you making it.
That's beautiful. Thank you. That helps.
Yeah, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Other thoughts or questions?
Dave, when you've made that recommendation, have you provided, I know you referenced going to send them an email and summarize, but are you providing that fee that your monthly retainer as well and then asking for a decision?
Just a second. I want to be sure I understand. Am I providing, what did you ask?
Are you providing the retainer fee? I know you're sending it in an email, but are you also providing it on, while you're on the phone with that individual?
Oh, absolutely. I want everything to be between me and that client. And this will get to one of the questions, do you put your fees on your website? No, I would suggest not, because somebody's going to make a decision outside a relationship, and probably for the wrong reason, and not know what that's included. Notice when I gave that illustration of making a recommendation, the number is the last thing I said, because that's the most likely thing that will trigger reaction. But if they have the entire framework of everything that we're doing together and going to do together and what it includes, and then the monthly retainer, I'll send you the link for the monthly retainer of $1,250, say. That's the because they have a whole context of weekly meetings of 50 minutes, material, resources, communication in between, the experience of our discussion, that this is an application for everything we've discussed, highlighting the needs and challenges they have that they can't do or be themselves, that we're going to do together. And I'm saying this with the knowledge of that and the confidence in when we work together, and you got to believe this, but when you do, it's powerful. When we work together, I'm not saying this to a client, but you need to believe that you're going to help that client get to a better place in their life or their business than they've ever been before. When you do that without saying it in those words, that instills confidence, and that's the midbrain to midbrain conveyance of a very positive state of mind. And then you work to get there together and to co-create it with all the story components that will need to be addressed.
Yeah. You also asked in terms of takeaways. I would just tell you that, you know, the takeaway for tonight is I really do like that we don't sell, that we make a professional recommendation. I think that's very powerful.
Ah, good. Good. Yeah, thanks.
I agree with you.
Yes. And one quick question, last question, was just how long are these audios available, do you know, on the website?
They should be available for some period of time, probably up to a year.
Okay, great. I have to hop to another call, but thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Other takeaways or other questions?
Mike, this is Benita.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. It's kind of like a follow-up and perhaps some guidance. For the first time, I'm facing a client who I believe is looking for a way out of contract. We've had about eight sessions together, and she missed two appointments, and then I received a phone call stating, could we have a conversation because it's not working out for me right now. I'm not achieving what I had hoped.
But she's saying that to you?
She said, yes, this is what she left in the message. So
okay.
I'm going to do a follow-up call, probably tomorrow, and because the session was scheduled for this week. But since she's canceled two and also did not honor the last payment, it did not come in as it should, I want some guidance on that conversation.
Okay.
It's the first time I've ever had anybody actually terminate. And
okay.
I expect that. Yes, please.
Can I ask you a couple of questions about the framework? What's the framework when you say the contract? tell me just in a sentence what the framework is of the agreement, the focus, and the method of payment. In just a sentence or two, Benita.
Right. The framework is she agreed in a collaborative model with me to work towards achieving success in relationship and in her health and fitness. So she identified certain goals that she wanted to accomplish. And, of course, weekly updates, we were working on that together.
What's the framework of how she pays her fee, just in a sentence, because of time?
I use the same model. Every month, she pays automatically. It comes in on the first of the month.
How does that work? You mean like PayPal? What?
It's automatically set up. $800
okay.
A month, she pays it. It's not really been late. She did move it to the middle of the month when she had a bit of a challenge. And I said, no problem. Would you like to negotiate the date that you make your payment? We moved it to the 12th.
Okay. Now, I don't think I know enough to make any specific comments, but there are two things that are striking. One is assume that our clients are always showing us exactly what it's like to be them, so that if someone doesn't show or doesn't fulfill a commitment they made to themselves at the end of the session, by the next session, they're showing us exactly what it's like to be them because they don't follow through. They have a plan, if they do, specifically, but they don't follow through. So that's the session. If she makes a commitment and doesn't follow through, there's no need to go off with something new and different because she's shown you exactly what needs to be addressed. Now, I wonder if there are specific enough focuses when you talk about those broad goals, success in relationships and wellness. Those are outcomes. How do you each session give her the model of creating a system of a map of where she is now and what she's going to do systematically each day and each hour between now and next time? Because it sounds like she needs a system, and only you could be the best hope of co-creating one that may be a model overall of commitment and obligation. But it's going to be down to what you talk about with each session. Do you ask her at the beginning of the session, what specifically would you like us to focus on? And then once becoming clear, where do you want us to get to? Because that's the model of the system that she's going to download. And a specific destination of that conversation is not going to be broad and general, but it's going to result in something that she can summarize in a sentence and put into a commitment of one or two or three things that she does before you meet again. And then if she doesn't do this, that's where you start, whether it's in looking at how she decides not to. Is it procrastination? Is it internal bargaining? That's the process that needs to be addressed, not the content. Because I think what you've talked about has been content, and I know, Benita, to address the process. So that's where the issue is here for her.
Yeah, we are using, we're going through the roadmap pretty well, and we marked through all of those steps. And she's been excellent at following up on those. I think that she has, I kind of alluded to that in an earlier talk today, of I think what happened. And I don't want to take up the time.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, it was the same thing, and I think that's what happened. I think there was a change, a transition, even though it was engaged when the husband got involved in it. I think that transition. And I think that's what's produced this outcome.
Your whole framework changed, and
so
much.
Even though that was under her control, it was a recommendation only because we were dealing with quality of relationship, and her initial objectives had to do with health, it had to do with career, and it had to deal with relationship, becoming closer with my family.
I'm going to interrupt you here. Those are good ideas, but they're not goals. Those are good ideas. Here's a good idea. I want to lose some weight and eat a healthier diet. here's a goal. I will weigh 185 pounds by September 30th. And, you know, the specificity and the framework here, I'd say pause and look at that and then look at it with her to recalibrate where you and she are, if that's a possibility, because she still has potential, she still has need, and the shift, I think, needs to be addressed in the framework. Okay.
I hope that was helpful.
Email me if there's another aspect of that.
Oh, I will. Rapid planning and goal-oriented
all
the time.
Okay. Okay. I want to give you guys an example. This is from some questions about how would you work with a client if there's something that you know that you're using something that you may know that could be a benefit to a client. Do you introduce? I say, of course. We do a lot of things in addition to asking powerful questions. Now, I'll say this, and this part will be deleted if the ICSF is listening and if you go for certification there. But here's an example, and this is to everyone. The most recent example occurred to me. I'm working with a financial planner who works with very high-profile and high-net-worth individuals. He had an upcoming meeting with a very wealthy potential client and mentioned it, and mentioned that this person had potentially $35 million to invest with him. And he asked if I had any suggestions. He knew, and we had worked on a whole number of things about, you know, the co-creation of stories and all that. And I decided to get very tangible because I knew this person was coming to his office. I said, when do you plan to meet with him and for how long? He said, well, I plan to meet probably for about 4 hours, and we're going to begin at 10 o'clock. I said, are you planning snacks or a lunch? He said, well, I hadn't thought about it, but we probably would end with a lunch and have snacks or maybe a lunch. I said, here's something to consider as you do this. The National Academy of Sciences did a study of 8 parole judges in Israel. The average parole rate for all of the judges for the 3 years running of the study was 35%. After a mid-morning and mid-afternoon snack, as well as lunch, the parole rates were much higher, 65%, almost twice as much. At the time when their blood glucose was lowest, just before lunch and just before the day ended, the parole rate was almost 0%. And he said, I think I'm going to have lunch before I do the final summation. I said, I think that's a good idea. And I said, where is this person in your office going to be sitting? And where are you going to be sitting? Or I'm assuming you're both going to be sitting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it. I assume. Well, let me tell you a study. These are things that influence decisions in addition to implicit biases that aren't necessarily thought about, but it may be helpful to think about. And I mentioned the study. 2 studies by Dr. Tomasini and Mazzoli in Italy showed that when someone speaks into a recipient's right ear, the positive response rate is 75% more successful than speaking in the person's left ear, regardless of handedness. Now, I'll add here to you guys, who knew? I've been talking in my wife's left ear all these years. So here's something that he said, well, I know where we're going to sit now. He gave me a progress note. Person invested $35 million. Who knows if this had any influence, but there's small little things that sometimes may make a difference, but it's helpful to know. So these are all components in addition to all the really important things we've talked about that could make a difference that may be important. And remember, I said in the beginning, I'll give you a quiz, and I'll tell you the answer later. We remember incomplete and interrupted tasks better. This is the Zeigarnik effect that I mentioned to you to look up if you had a chance with my blog, that this was the discovery by a social scientist that when there is an interruption, that like in a waiter's order, the order is remembered significantly better than if it's complete, because it's then dismissed, or you move on to something else, or change the frame. So these are things that could be important to think about, and you know, maybe alongside the things that are really important, like the collaboration and collaboration with a client. Now, there's another set of questions that had to do with a disclaimer and waiver forms about, do I need a waiver form for my practice or a malpractice or anything like that? Dissatisfaction claim for refunds filed against me. In my view, I don't think you have to worry about that. And now, I have a client agreement page. It's a half of a page that is at the back of the client information packet that when I did my little ditty about, I'll send you my client information packet. I'll send you a couple of things that if you can attend to them before our first session. One is the client information packet, and that's two or three pages of basic information that means the session begins before it starts. Somebody thinks about their, the challenges, what they want to do with you, what they want from you. The last page is an agreement. Now, I happen to have had mine vetted by a couple of attorneys because I come from a background of healthcare, so it clearly spells out what coaching is. What coaching isn't, it isn't healthcare, insurance doesn't apply, and that's something that a client will sign electronically is fine prior to a first session. So basically, I don't know any coaches who have malpractice. Now, there are three or four who have a policy that was designed for people on boards of directors, called errors and omissions, and this is probably more relevant if you do executive coaching. But I do think you need that agreement with every client, whether it's both people in a couple, everyone in a group, or your individual, because they're agreeing to work with you in coaching, and they have a signed agreement indicating they know what coaching is and what coaching isn't, and they've agreed to you so. That's important, I think, I've heard Lloyd's of London may have something that might be applicable for coaches, but I don't know any, and I know a bunch who have that. So I don't think you have to worry about that, but I definitely would, with every client, do an agreement with them. So I hope that helps with that question. Anything else that we haven't talked about or we have inadequately that you'd like to talk about more, or ask about, or add here?
David, this is Jody. I have one question.
Yeah.
Just going back a little bit to payments. I know it's not maybe not a part of this course, but I was looking throughout my coaching booklet that I'm in.
Okay.
In that we're not doctors, I understand, and I know you keep reference to our business as a practice. Are we inclusive or exclusive in working with insurance policies or claiming payment from medical insurance? I guess the answer is no, that as medical, right?
Never.
Because you said we're part of the healthcare.
Yeah, there's not just a thin gray line between healthcare and coaching. There's a broad black line, and that includes being very clear that what we do in coaching is not therapy and is not counseling. Healthcare insurance does not apply. So that's something to be very clear about and have those boundaries clearly in mind so that there's no question about that. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. As
okay.
I said, I throughout the course. I'm in the CPA course, but it didn't mention it, so I wanted to be clear.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Good question and good thing to be very, very clear about.
Yeah.
Who else? Anything else?
This is Elizabeth.
Yeah, please.
I kind of found it a little bit interesting that my biggest struggle in this coaching thing is just stepping out there and approaching anybody as potential clients and marketing myself that way, just introducing whatever. And so I've started doing that after doing the first class now, or the first session, and I just started putting myself out there more. And this week I just laughed because I've gotten more confident in doing that. And so I just closed my construction business, but I'm still getting phone calls from people wanting to loan me some money, and I know it's for my construction business. And so I let them give their sales pitch, and I said, well, actually, you know what, I closed that business, but I started another one. Even though I don't need money, I became a life coach, and I jumped right into that. And I actually, on Thursday, I got a guy that, through the sales pitch to me, that he's going to hire me to be his coach. And I just cracked up laughing. I'm like, it just hit my funny bone that this actually is working in a bigger, broader spectrum than I had anticipated. And part of it was just marketing. This was my biggest
congratulations,
you know, struggle,
on that.
So.
Let's ask a practical question. How many conversations and how much time does it take for you doing it that way for a conversion to a client? And is there a potentially more effective direct way to do it as a coaching professional, not converting somebody?
Right. Well,
how much time have you spent on conversations like that to get to glean this one client? Time, give me a number. A number.
I'm going to just say like a half an hour.
No, for all total,
give
you a second. I want to interrupt you. All total, all the conversations with all the people that want to loan you money, what's the total number of hours to get this one person so far?
Well, there was 4 phone calls, and he was the second person that I approached this way.
So that's 2 hours? Total?
Yes.
Well, you know, that's one way to do it. Think about other ways, and what you'll find is each of you proceed organically. What's the very best way to do this? You know, I usually urge someone to think about the very best and easiest way is to look at their already existing relationships when they have existing relationship. These are people who know you, who trust you, who probably did business or referred to you before. When they find out, when you send them, let's say, a letter of announcement of the opening of your practice for professional coaching and clarify what you do and offer a complimentary sample session, you've become exponentially more effective in doing that with 200 people than fielding some cold calls from people who want to loan you money and you convert them. Now, it worked in this instance. You may find that's the best. You may streamline that. But I'd say look at really what's more effective and what you want to do with your professional time and how you want to proceed with that. And this is to everyone. Thanks for sharing that. That's really interesting. You know,
I do want to clarify that. I have done those things also, but as far as for where else can I step outside of that box, you know, and when I started just approaching each person. So I was saying this is above and beyond my normal marketing, and that is not the tactic that I'm going to try to sell on everybody, but that I used that opportunity.
Okay. That's a great idea. Someone not too long ago in one of my classes said, you know, I went to the car wash and the you know, I've seen the manager ask, what are you up to? What are you doing these days? And I told him, I'm a professional coach. And he became a client of mine because of that. And she said, what do you think? And I said, I think you ought to get your car washed more often. You find what works, and you do that, and what's consistent with your professional identity, each of you, and what you want to do with your professional identity. So I think those are great illustrations. We're really at the end of the half hour past this. Thank you all again very much. I'll be eager to hear what you do with this. You know, you have my email. I'm eager to hear a progress note or an update. If I can be of help to any of you, please let me know. And thanks again for all of your energy, participation, and the discussion. You've really brought it alive and helped me focus more on what will be of more benefit to you by the questions and the objectives that you each had. I hope this has been beneficial, and I'll be eager to hear what you do with it. Thanks again very, very much.
Thank you, Dave.
It was great.
Thank you, Dave.
See you guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.